The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Let's take a look at your Sunday papers. And I have to say, this is the first time in a few years, certainly the last few years that I can remember, that the Sunday Independent doesn't have the budget as its lead story on the front page 2 days out from it. Instead, they are talking about the National Children's Hospital. The headline, Donnelly, I want to see BAM board over delays at hospital. He sent a letter, according to the paper and Maeve Sheehan, to the firm's parents group, to BAM's parent group, to talk about the cost overruns of the hospital. So the overall group that owns BAM Ireland seeming to go over those heads, although Minister Donnelly not confirming the story this weekend. The budget does make the off-lead in The Independent, with ideological clashes in cabinet over budget details. The lead story, or the lead line, I suppose, out of the budget there being this last-minute row over how social welfare is going to increase. Fine Gael seeking a €15 increase in the pension and €20 in benefits for new parents, but lower hikes for job seekers allowance in around the €10 mark. While Fine Gael, or Fianna Fáil rather, and the Greens are pushing back against that, saying it would create a social divide effectively. Moving to the Sunday Times, and the budget makes the front page there, along with a large picture of Johnny Sexton and extracts from his new book, with the pull quote, "On O'Gara, I called him a coward," and that really set him off, as well, you can imagine it would. The lead story, though, is pensioners to get at least €12 per week in the budget. Hugh O'Connell and Claire Scott saying a €10 increase in the core rate of child benefit, or a second double child benefit payment before the end of the year, in addition to the one already planned for November, is what's in store. Also, that row about the dole increases. Fine Gael sources telling the paper that limiting dole increases for those, as one put it, unemployed for years on end, would free up more money for increases in targeted payments at low income families. Moving to the Business Post, and the front page also talking about the budget there. €28 billion budget day bonanza. And the maths that they have done on that is that you've got an €8.3 billion core budget package, 6.9 of spending and 1.4 in taxation measures, the €14 billion from the Apple tax money, €3 billion from the sale of AIB shares, €1.5 billion from the surpluses from the National Training Fund, and a partridge in a pear tree, at least according to the paper. The coalition will be using most of the €17 billion Apple and AIB windfall to try and improve the country's creaking infrastructure, is the angle that they have taken. And then on the front page of the Mail on Sunday is in relation to legal bills at the HSE-funded Stewart's Care charity. And inside the paper, they're also going with the budget, and particularly the headline being, "It's budget handbags at the Dáil." And this is about, is in a couple of the papers, a big row apparently during the week between Pascal Donoghue, the Public Expenditure Minister, and Roger O'Gorman, the Green Party leader and Children's Minister, in which apparently Pascal Donoghue was quite short with him and patronising, according to one Green Party source, and it ended without any sort of agreement. That seems to be one of the last big departments that hasn't got its budget sorted yet, with a big difference between what Pascal Donoghue and Jack Chambers are willing to give and what the ministers actually want ahead of this budget. So plenty in the papers there on the budget coming up in 2 days, and we're going to get into that now with my newspaper panel. I'm joined by John Cunningham, Chair of the SERP Institute, Relationship Director at Morgan McKinley, and Chairman Country Director at the Lysis Group, Sinead Moriarty, writer and author, with her new books Fixing Mom and Dad and Good Sisters have just been published, and Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. Morning to you all. Thanks a million for coming in for the pre-budget festivities.
Yeah, exactly.
Dan, listen, we might start with you. This all feels like, and I was listening to the Sinn Féin Ardéis yesterday and the speech promising everything and anything from Mary Lou McDonald, it all feels like it's getting a bit of a runaway and people are promising an awful lot of things. What's your overall take on what we're seeing in the budget?
Well, if somebody works for an international affairs think tank and talks to people in other countries, it is just so remarkably different how our conversation is going on here. If we look at our neighbours in Britain, it's huge controversies about cutting pensioners' winter fuel allowances. In France, the new Prime Minister, a man we know well, Michel Barnier, is worried about becoming an ex-Liz Truss. They have so little money. Every country in Europe, pretty much, is in on their uppers. And it's back to discussions about austerity. Any money that exists needs to go on defence spending because of the threat of Russia. Totally transformed. We're sitting off in this island in the middle of the Atlantic. Money is flowing in. Nothing can go wrong. Happy days. It's a really different situation here. So that's just an observation about how we're sort of living in some sort of fairyland. And hopefully it'll continue, but There you go.
Well, yeah, that sounds like a recipe disaster for what you're saying there, that there is a bubble here that is going to pop. Am I right?
No,
is that wrong?
I'm emphatically, in fact, writing in the currency website just at the moment saying there is not a bubble. So yeah. People are not indebted. Banks haven't lent too much. It is not like the last time, nor is the government spending as crazily as they did in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. So there is not, I'm not worried about some sort of imminent collapse. I'm simply making an observation that we are just, it's so different here from the rest of our continent, where people are worried about being invaded if you go east, and they're worried about financial crisis and running out of money and austerity in Britain and France. So it's just, it's very different. I think it's worth just making that observation. Yeah. We can often be quite insular in our thinking and not look how different we are. And in this case, fortunately, we're different in a fortunate way rather than an unfortunate way, as we were maybe 12 years ago when we were bankrupt and run by the IMF.
And why is it so different here? Is the benefit of good tax policy? Is it a bit of luck that people warehouse here because they've had, the lower corporation tax rates? Why is it so jarringly different from, in particular, the UK, which we were always traditionally tied to?
Yeah, but it's because our foreign direct investment policy of attracting companies from abroad, and that has worked in a miraculous way beyond anything anyone could ever anticipate. So there is some luck in it. Nobody would have thought that we would have picked the two perfect industries, pharmaceuticals, which are recession-proof, and tech, which is this, taken over the world. These are these two supercharged engines we have strapped on to an economy that up until, the 1990s hadn't grown It was the laggard for 120 years since the famine. Like, we were just the laggard of Northwestern Europe. Mm. We strapped on these two twin engines of tech and pharma, and they just caused the economy to soar into the stratosphere. And they are still burning at, white hot speed. They are generating jobs, hundreds of thousands of people, both directly and indirectly in these sectors, high paying jobs. They're generating incredible exports. And of course, they're generating tens of billions in tax. This government has collected 120 billion euro in corporation tax. Yeah. Now, that is just off the charts compared to our peers. It's just, we are so much more dependent on profit taxes than any other country. That's a vulnerability. Of course, it's also a good thing in the sense that we have this totally different conversation that when we talk about budgets, now we're talking about giveaways. All our neighbors are talking about where we cut, where's the austerity? Mm-hmm. Cut, 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 cut. We're talking about spend. It's worth making a point.
I think also what it puts to rest is, if you think of the last 18 months and the rhetoric from the largest opposition party and talking about Ireland being a failed state. Now, for all of the problems that there are and the challenges, it is really important to acknowledge the fact that the Irish economy, through policy, through investment decisions, tax, has turned out to be an extraordinarily successful economy, both in an economic sense and a social sense. And I think that, watching the bit of the Sinn Féin over there yesterday, so many of the arguments that they've been thrashing around have been diminished and removed. But again, it's just fascinating. We're just saying it inside that, I was just talking to Sinead as you're preparing. The fact that we're discussing how much you're going to be giving back and whether it's 12 quid or 15 quid is phenomenal. So, I think the details of the next few days, we'll see what's going to happen on Tuesday, is going to be, you just hope there's going to be that absolutely strategic and intelligent decisions that have been made. Because for me, and again, just a point in infrastructure, we'll probably discuss it, but, I sit on the Dublin Chamber Council, and water as an example. If they don't fix the water pipe that's going to come from the Midlands into Dublin, there'll be no water in Dublin in 8 years' time.
But is this not the problem where politics and money intersect, in that that's a huge political issue because people down in the West don't want the water from the Shannon going up to Dublin, and they're not going to make that decision prior to the election. So you have all this money, and in theory, yes, we could do some big infrastructure things, but if you say you're going to get spend it on the metro, all the TDs in Cork say, no, that's a big Dublin project, we don't want that. If you spend it on the Shannon pipeline, they say you're taking water from the Shannon, and that's where the waste in this budget could come in.
Yeah, but that's where you hope, and if I could use that phrase, that they'll have the balls to make the right decision strategically, because again, there's a bit of a perfect storm at the moment with regard to the finances that are available. We won't even mention the Apple figure, all right? But if that infrastructure stuff isn't fixed, they will suffer the consequences of this in the longer term with regard to whether it's the next election or the election after. If they don't fix the important stuff, all of the progress that they've made and their position will be diminished completely. I would certainly have huge regard for any government that's willing to make those hard decisions. And you're absolutely right. It'll be interesting to see with the coalition and the conflict whether they'll be able to make those decisions on Tuesday with regard to the hard expenditure that needs to be made. But if you don't fix it, I mean, you can talk about all the jobs in the world and converting apartments over the shops. If there's no water in Dublin City, as the capital, okay, the place is shut down.
Sinead, what's caught your eye? There's an awful lot in the paper today about it. Anything in particular standing out to you as a big win or something they shouldn't be doing?
Yeah, I mean, just a kind of on that point, I think, you know, important things like, you know, land hoarding tax, that also hopefully will be pushed through. I think that if there is an election, which everybody believes there will be very soon, you know, whichever government comes in will hopefully make those tough decisions and also look at long term as opposed to short term, which is, I think, a mistake we've made in the past. I suppose for me, you know, as somebody who works in the arts, I'm kind of exercised by the fact that the Arts Council are seeking 160 million. The problem with it is, I think during COVID, we really learned to value the arts even more than before. It's important to everything. We are having a golden era in Ireland at the moment, but you can't have a golden era without funding and increased funding. And just for an example, just to give an example, like last year, the Arts Council were only able to fund 51% of eligible requests. Now, the requests have gone up, to be fair, for funding, but still, we need to increase the budget for that. And I hope they do get the 160 million that they are seeking because it is really important. Artists are being crippled by the cost of housing, the cost of living. Nearly everybody I know has a second job. And, you know, I just think we need to value the arts more in this country. You know, and hopefully they will, you know, I mean, Catherine Martin has certainly done a good job in the past. And I hope that they do get the funding that they deserve. This.
Have you heard much about this trial basic income scheme for the arts that Catherine Martin did bring in and is under review in this budget? Has it actually helped? Have many people got it? Like, is it making an influence in the art community?
It certainly hasn't been. It's not something that has made much of a difference so far anyway.
OK.
I just really think that, you know, people do really struggle. And also, if you compare us to, like, say, foreign countries, like most of the European average for arts funding is 0.6% of the GDP. And here it's only 0.1%.
Right.
So I think we just need to, you know, value the arts and also space. For artists, the key is time and space. And you can't have time if you have to have a part-time job.
So what kind of measures help that?
Funding. And so that people can get, you know, bursaries. It's time. It's time. People can rent spaces and people can actually live not in squalor, you know, those kind of things.
One of the rounds that's kind of struck me as interesting, John, is in relation to the childcare budget and that isn't finalised. And there's a big piece in the Mail there you have in front of you about this row between Pascal Donoghue and Roger O'Gorman, and one was allegedly belittling the other. But in an economy where childcare is such a big issue for people, that one isn't getting a lot more funding and seems to be one of the last things to be nailed down. It's sort of surprising me about this budget.
And again, it's one of those things that could derail the election, I think, in the context of when the real debate starts. Let's assume at the moment that, even though they're all denying it, the election's going to be the 15th of November or sometime around that, we suspect, all right? And the childcare thing is just one that, and by the way, they've pumped billions into it, still haven't fixed it. But if they don't strategically get that right, and again, this goes back to making choices, the whole sense of the papers today is, oh God, if they spread it too thin and try and do a bit everywhere again, they'll have no impact at all. And you'd really rather some really key decisions, which are, look, we're going to sort out the childcare. We're going to invest in it properly and ensure that people aren't paying a mortgage in a half a month to have their two kids minded so they can go back to work. So again, just the hope is, and it's not beyond their wit, that they have the intelligence and the balls to make those really, really important strategic decisions. Because if they don't, I think they could be derailed. And again, at the moment, you saw yesterday with Sinn Féin, all Sinn Féin are doing is spending money that they don't have. The government know what the situation is. They have access to the balance sheet. And let's really hope that they make those kind of really important decisions. And you can assume they've all the research done. They know what's causing the pain and housing and immigration are easy things to go to. But the bottom line is that ultimately, that childcare one is one that could really come up and bite them in the backside.
On that housing point, Dan, a lot of people, a lot of parties, opposition parties, Labour included, have been saying you need to spend the Apple tax money on housing. It all needs to go into housing infrastructure. But the point would occur to me that just pumping money into housing doesn't solve the problem because you don't have the surfeit of staff, you don't have builders, you don't have whatever that can go and fix it just by putting in X amount of billions. Am I right in that, or do you think pumping the money in like that will fix it?
Well, where are the builders? Are there? We have full employment here. Employment has been growing. There's very few people who are unemployed. Are you going to suddenly magic up 30,000 builders? No, is the short answer. So it's not as simple as simply as throwing money at it. And it should be said, as a central bank report did the numbers on this. There's only one country in Europe that spends more money on housing, public money on housing, than Ireland. So we are way above the norm in terms of how much taxpayers' money goes into building public housing and subsidising housing. So we're already very, very unusual in the amount of money that's spent on housing in various forms.
Mm. To go into the social welfare row then, because that's another one that's big in the papers today, the Fine Gael saying give less of an increase, give a 10 euro increase to people who are on job seekers and on long-term unemployment because they don't really contribute to the economy, seems to be the argument. Is there logic in that, or is it one that's going to create a social divide between giving, say, 15 euro to the pensioners and other people, carers?
Okay, so in a full employment, like if you go to somewhere like Denmark, if you become unemployed, you get about 80% of your salary for a few months. So it doesn't affect, losing a job doesn't have a huge impact on your family and
That's something they tried to imitate here, tapered, in fairness, with this new policy.
And it's tapered off. And then it becomes much more difficult to get unemployment benefit unless you're showing that you're looking for work. Now, in an economy like ours, where we're not only have extremely low unemployment, but we're importing lots of people to work because we have so many jobs, I can't see how it makes any sense to be increasing unemployment benefit for people who are on long-term unemployment. Now, if somebody is on long-term unemployment for a health reason, for example, there's a disability payment. That needs to be, somebody could move over to that if there was an issue. But if somebody is perfectly healthy and on long-term unemployment in a full employment environment, like let's just remember, social welfare is a net. Okay, it's to help people when we have problems in our lives. It is not a hammock where you just stay in it over the long term. So I don't think there is any logic in increasing unemployment benefit for people who are in long-term unemployment at a time of full employment.
Mm. Sinead, what are your thoughts on that? Because the Green Party seems to be particularly pushing back on this, and Fianna Fáil, saying that if you don't give the increase, that in the inflationary environment that we live in, it's actually the children of these people who suffer, those people who are long-term unemployed.
Well, I think what Dan was saying is interesting. I think, you know, if people are allowed just to sit in it, they will. I think there has to be like a motivating reason to go out and get a job. And if you're not going to change your weekly, why would you bother? Mm. Like there has to be an incentive and there has to be an end point as well. Because otherwise, why would you bother?
But it's also not like it's a huge amount of money, John. I mean, you know, there's not people sitting there living a high life on the state on whatever it is, 215, 230 a week.
No, but for many families, it's enough to allow them function at a level that they choose to function at. And so one of the issues is, and I see it in the budget this year, there's 1.5 billion of the training and skills development budget that is unspent, all right? So again, about going back to what happens in Europe. So they'd take those long-term unemployed and they divide them into those who are sick or unable to work. And then there'd be others who are available to work but don't. And then they'd put all these very particular training programs in place to reskill them and make them available for other activities. Now, first of all, that's very easy for me to say of somebody who isn't unemployed and drawing kind of the supports. But again, the point is, when you'd love to have an intelligent conversation about it, and to have that conversation, say, what are we at, Dan? Is it 4.2% unemployment, which is technically full employment? Have they really looked at 4.2%? Who are those people?
Mm.
Break it down. Really be strategic about it. Put the supports in place to get people back into work. Because we know that work and earning a living is the thing that gives you both confidence and gives you support and get you going. Yeah.
And just to reiterate, and Sean, you said it's not a lot of money. You're absolutely right about that. Okay. The amount we spend on unemployment benefit is actually not very much in the broader scheme of things. But it's not about the money. It's about what's good for people.
Yeah.
Somebody who's in long-term unemployment, it's not just as John absolutely rightly said, the children of people who are on long-term unemployed are hugely more likely to go down a bad route in their later lives and emulate their parents. So if kids see their parents not working over a long time, that becomes a sort of cultural factor. So it is really important from a social justice perspective, a word that you use a lot these days, that people are encouraged to go to work, not just for themselves, but for their kids, because their kids will then perpetuate that cycle. So it's not about the money, it's about social justice, to borrow that.
Yeah, term. Well, we should say not every kid would follow down that route.
Not everyone, but they're much more likely. It's absolutely a fact. They are much, much more likely emulate their parents.
But does that, because I grew up in a council estate and I saw the mix of both of it, in that, you know, you had some families and everyone started at a pretty poor level of money. You had some families where the kids went on and did very well and got college educations and some families where they didn't. Is education the way out of that, or what's the best way out of it, Sinead?
Yep, well, I think education is always the best way out, you know. And if you read any, you know, books about people who started with very difficult beginnings and rose to the top, it generally is about education and staying in education. I think it is really important. I think I understand what Dan is saying there, but I think that's one of the things I think is good about the potential for the budget, is that they're going to cut college fees, they're going to give free books to kids during the Leaving
Cert
cycle,
I
think is huge, because like the cost of books is crippling for people. September is the most expensive month for every family. So I think that's huge. And I think we have to figure out ways to keep children in school. That's the key as well. So I think hopefully those things will come through, the reduced college fees and then, the free books. I think they're very important.
A positive, I know we talk about all the negatives these days. We have crushed the high school dropout rate, the Americans call it. The number of kids who are leaving education has absolutely plummeted. Yeah. We're one of the lowest in Europe. We've really got that right. So good news point.
And then on the day and the week, we're going to have all these billions to spend. To me, one of the greatest challenges we've got is the lack of investment in third level education. Mm. And the universities are absolutely crying out for proper investment. Poor old Chuck Feeney has passed on and has given all his money away. And if it wasn't for Chuck Feeney, half the university in this country would not be functioning. And there's a real... It's the one thing that people used to always say, Ireland, the only English-speaking country in the EU, now that Britain is gone, our education... Which we talk about our education system in an almost historic sense. We have this view that we have this brilliant education system, and it's superb. But you talk to any of the university, and they struggle to pay their lecturers, to... The reason we don't appear on the internationals, we don't have the money for research. So to me, again, when it comes to those strategic conversations, education has been the bedrock of Ireland's success, going back to the 50s and the 60s and Donegal Mally and all the way through. And if they don't embrace this properly, and back to Sinead's point, it's the two things that stand out for me is the €1,000 back for somebody and their university fees and the free books. I mean, it reminds you just those two things that will stick in your head after this budget. If that's what they do, you'll remember that. It's a bit like the Bannon the coal and Mary Harney and the plastic bag tax. They stand out as being two logical, strategic things that are supporting children and young people in education.
Can I also just say again, a lot of this does come back to housing, because we're hemorrhaging teachers.
Yeah.
Like, I've got three kids in senior cycle, and there wasn't a maths teacher for months. There wasn't we're hemorrhaging teachers. They're all going abroad. A lot of them are going to kind of Dubai at the moment now, because they're getting much better, getting paid better, and they can save. But that is a real issue. I mean, a lot of things do circle back to the issue around housing.
One of the texts in on that message: our infrastructure is in shambles. No one wants to be a guard or a nurse or a teacher. People are afraid to go near a hospital. Schools packed, and all of our beautiful educated young bailing out as they're fed up of living at home or renting a box room at rip-off rent. Nothing sure they will squander this money, and we will back to square one in 10 years. We're going to pick up back on that point and the education point. Listening to the Anton Savage Show with Sean Defoe, and my panel are with me, John Cunningham, Sinead Moriarty and Dan O'Brien. And just before the break, we were talking about education and its importance in the budget. And John, I just wanted to jump off with you into that, because there's a lot of talk in the papers about different departments that would be set up. A Department of Infrastructure, Simon Harris wants, Mary Lou talking about a Minister for United Ireland. The one that was there at the last election was a Department for Higher Education, which I thought was superfluous at the time. And I still think that. I don't think it's actually made the key difference that you were talking about in funding and putting the importance there for higher education that will secure it into the future.
Well, the fact that none of us can put our hand or point to anything that materially came of it, I'm quite sure they've done some phenomenal work with regard to policy, with regard to aspirations and everything else. But my observation is, I'm not aware of any great change that came from it. And as I said earlier, I mean, to me, the biggest issue is you could have all the departments you want. If the universities aren't being funded effectively, we're setting ourselves up for failure in the future. And we had this conversation again just a few moments ago with regard to education is the gateway to success and participation in society. And if they don't get it right, we're banjaxed.
Mm. Dan, we were talking in the break about the Department of Infrastructure. And do you think there's any worth to it? We haven't done some big projects in this country very well. Children's Hospital being highlighted this week as one case in point. Would organising it into one department make things any better?
No.
Right. There we go. Simple word. Why not?
It's one of these things that politicians like to appear to be doing things. Let's set up a department. Okay. Now, back in the 70s, we set up something called a Department for Economic Planning and Development. It was an absolute disaster. Why? Because economic planning and development has many different departments involved. You set up a Department of Infrastructure. Who knows more about schooling infrastructure? Department of Education. Who knows more about health infrastructure? Department of Health. The idea that you can centralise a function that different ministries are going to do is an absolute nonsense. So this idea of a Department for Infrastructure is pure political nonsense. Mm. It is a very bad idea. It won't work, and it is just an attempt to give an appearance that something's going to happen. On the unity thing, it would be different because that is a major issue. But let's be honest, all the polling shows unity is not coming down the line anytime soon. So, you know, that's it's more for academics and commentators to talk about it. We don't need civil servants, highly paid civil servants, planning for something that really is not going to happen, barring some sort of huge change. And if we didn't have that change with Brexit, I can't see it coming within my lifetime.
I suppose the thing is, though, you can't have that without planning. So yeah, the Sinn Féin argument in particular would be, if we don't start planning for it now, it will never happen. And so getting that underway with a new minister or minister of state is step one on a long road.
Well, a minister is not going to change public opinion. And this is ultimately about public opinion. The first step in moving towards unification would be a British minister sitting in London deciding, I think it's time for a referendum in Northern Ireland, because it looks like public opinion is moving in the direction of supporting it. There is not a shred of evidence from all of the polling that the people of Northern Ireland, if they were asked about United Ireland, would vote in favour of it today. And that's despite Brexit, despite everything that's happened. There is not a shred of evidence that it's even close.
Mm.
So why would we sit down and start paying civil servants a lot of money to plan for something that the people of Northern Ireland are not going to vote for? And there is no evidence that there's been an increase in the number of people who are going to vote for it. And it's not even close. So reunification, the people of Northern Ireland, all the evidence shows they are not ready to vote for change.
Mm. But in saying that, I absolutely agree. And again, I'm just going to refer to the ARANS research project, which is within the Royal Irish Academy. And ARANS stands for the Analysing and Researching Ireland North and South. They've been doing phenomenal research. I keep thinking of all my time with Sister Stan. She used to say, remove the emotions, stick with the facts. Mm. The issues that are being raised, and it's available on the Royal Irish Academy website, is extraordinary. The issues over the health system, housing, education, the flag, all these things have already been identified. What I would love to be part of, Dan, is an intelligent and articulate conversation about what this would ultimately mean. From my point of view at the moment, all I can think of is the £13.5 billion a year that Whitehall plays to keep the lights on in the north of Ireland. Where will that come from and how will it work? So my sense of it is, get the information, get the data which is available, and commence a conversation. Now, I think we've seen, as Dan said, appointing ministers dedicated to anything doesn't work. And again, if I could just refer quickly, you mentioned, Sean, about the National Children's Hospital. To think that neither the Department of the Taoiseach nor the Department of Health felt either willing to take responsibility for the building, and they appointed an independent board rather than do it themselves, that to me was a sign of failure. And I'm not too sure if the board is ultimately fit for purpose. And all BAM were ever asked to do was to build the hospital, not design it. And it sounds like, from my reading of it, that there's a huge load of indecision and a whole load of changes taking place. So the north of Ireland, get the data, commence the conversation. I think what's interesting is this whole discussion now, I think, was Leo Varadkar kind of referred to it, that the Dáil in general should just have an acknowledgement that we're all interested in a united Ireland in principle.
Mm.
So it's not going to be a political football to play with. It's not a Sinn Féin issue or a Fianna Fáil issue. It's a national acknowledgement that at some stage in the future, we'd like to have a united Ireland. So that, to me, could be an interesting way of just commencing that conversation. But no more ministers, please.
Yeah, Sinead, what do you think on that? Because obviously everyone could say they're committed to Northern Ireland, and you see, you know, Fianna Fáil will say they're a Republican Party and all the rest of it. But unless you're actually taking concrete steps towards it, is there anything much to be done on this side of the water as opposed to either in Northern Ireland or in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Dan and John are saying, I think one of the main issues is it's going to cause huge financial stress. I mean, I suppose you have to look at, one can only learn from history. So if you look, let's say, at Germany and all the problems they've had, I know it's not the same, but I mean, they are one of the few countries that in Europe that have had this big reunification. I think, you know, as John said, there's such an nitty-gritty to get into, like, what happens to the British citizens? Do they become EU citizens? Which legal order should be preserved? Who to govern a united Ireland? Like, there are so many things that we need to discuss before even getting to that stage. And as Dan said, certainly with the young people, I don't think there's a huge interest or investment in this. So if you want to get this moving, you're going to have to do a lot of work.
Yeah, well, that's kind of an interesting one. Like, do you think that attitude is gone from young people? Because a lot of people, we were saying even in the break, are sort of soft Republican. I in a way, like this idea of a united Ireland. But when it comes to looking at that nitty gritty you're talking about, might say, actually, I'm okay.
Well, I don't think they know that much about it, to be honest with you. They're certainly, for like kids who grew up, let's say kids who are now 20, they haven't really known any violence, or the North hasn't been the front of every news item, which is what happened when we grew up. I don't think they know that much about it or that interested in it. I mean, I'm not saying it's a great thing, but...
But there's also a fragility still, and I think we've got to be really careful after all the success and the 25 years of them. There's a wonderful priest, Father Steve McBrearty, who's a chaplain to the prisons in the north of Ireland, who I know. And I remember 2 or 3 years ago, he said to me, John, he was dealing with 17, 18 and 19-year-olds in prison who described themselves as ready for war. They weren't even alive, so they've been radicalised, okay? So we can take not for granted for one moment the peace in the north. And I think that in that broader context, again, look, an intelligent, articulate, strategic debate about what it might look like. Because I think the reality is there is a shift, Dan, there is a shift towards it being a reality. But what does it look like and how are we going to plan for it? And who's going to be the intelligent person in the room to manage that conversation?
Yeah, one of the texts in, Dan. Good morning. Perhaps Sinn Féin are talking about unification more and more as a way of normalising the topic, making more of a comfortable topic in the years to come. And a second one, kind of agreeing with your point there, Sinead. Hi, Sean. I'm not interested in a united Ireland, and I'm not alone in not being interested in a united Ireland.
Yeah, well, one thing that always strikes me, I lived most of my adult life abroad and coming back here 15, 14 years ago, how little people here in the South know about the North. You know, we criticise the Brits, oh, they don't know anything about Ireland. We Irish in the South know nothing about Northern Ireland. How often do you hear about rent issues in Northern Ireland, about housing issues? Very few people I know go up there. Very few people I know have friends there. A lot of people actually will openly say, I'm not interested in that part of my own country. So if you're not even interested in that part of your own country, do you want to bring those people into your state and take all of the difficulties, John said? It is a highly divided society. It is a very different society in many ways. We want to have that in a state and deal with all of the complexities of that. It'll be tough. It won't be like Germany, where all the East Germans wanted to come into West Germany. Won't be like that.
But also, again, is that sense that, you know, issues of identity. And again, through this Aaron's research, I've attended a number of the events where in the North, you can identify as either being Irish, British or Northern Irish. And those who identify as Northern Irish talk about going to England or going to Britain, where they feel marginalised, diminished and not part of anything in particular. And they have a sense, I mean, somebody else described, he said, you know, living in the North, you kind of get the feeling that Britain doesn't really want them. And they're kind of thinking, you know, dear God, if we, you know, ask the wrong question, we could find ourselves very badly stuck. So to me, I think we're so far beyond talking about the practicality of a united Ireland. But please, let's have an articulate, intelligent debate. There's lots of really interesting data out there. And let's commence the conversation. And as I said previously, no minister, thank you.
That Royal Irish Academy that John refers to, it's very good stuff. So if anyone is really interested in understanding it, Google Royal Irish Academy Aaron's project. And there's really interesting stuff. So people who are genuinely intellectually curious about it, there's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, let us know what you think. WhatsApp 087-1400-106. Are you interested in a united Ireland, or are you not that bothered? Let's move on to the rest of what Sinn Féin were saying yesterday. They obviously had their Ardèche in Athlone. Did any of you watch Marilyn McDonald's speech?
No.
0 for 3. Wow. Well, that kind of tells you. That's actually instructive, because the one thing that I did watch is Sinead, and the one thing that struck me about it was, it was actually quite boring. And for a party that had such a zeitgeist 4 years ago in 2020, they've become a bit boring.
Well, I think as what John was saying earlier, like a lot of what they were giving out about is now no longer an issue. You know what
mainstream.
I mean? A lot of things have been covered. I think also they probably got a bit swallowed by the budget and all the attention that was getting. Can I just say one thing just about the third level? We're talking about the Minister for Third Level and everything. One of the main issues, I think, at the moment is because the universities are struck for money, as John was saying, now that Chuck is gone, they're getting loads of foreign students, overseas students in. They're taking up the spaces, but they're paying the big cash. But that's another issue. So we need to fund the university so that we're not reliant on overseas students.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because to go back to that point, and we were talking about the social welfare and the reason we can't have education was it being a way out of it. There were quite a few texts in on that, Dan, some of them disagreeing with what you were saying initially about it not being a good investment. So, one of the texts, don't forget a large number of so-called long-term unemployed are pensioners who had to retire from the job at 65 but can't get the state pension until they're 66 and are paid social welfare to cover to the retirement age. And second text, there will always be a certain section of society that are unemployable. If you don't acknowledge that, you're missing a crucial point, how you treat these is the difference between how their children's future will be shaped.
And that's absolutely right. But it is the unemployment benefit system is for people who've lost their jobs and are working for another one, looking for another one. You have various schemes, disability payment. If, and it's absolutely true, there are some people that are unemployable, have difficulties in their lives, have mental health issues. We have systems to help those people, and that is absolutely right. But we need to distinguish between things like disability benefit given to people who can't find work or not able to find employment, and the unemployment net, which is a net in the short term to help people get back into work. So just distinguish between those two things.
Do we have any data, the data that John was looking for earlier, on how many people, how many of that 4.2% of unemployed are in disability or are a carer or whatever? We don't have a break.
No. Anybody who's on, there are totally separate schemes. So if you get a disability allowance and you're not included in the unemployment figures, if you are on disability benefit, you're not on the unemployment figures at all.
So the 4.2 is purely people who are not working,
exactly,
but could work in theory.
Exactly. 4.2 of the entire labour force. Now, most of those people are just between jobs. So you lose your job, you go, you get your unemployment benefit, and you come off it. So most of that 4.2 is short-term. People who just have been laid off, can't find a job, need help, support to get them through it. I actually think that money, as I said, in Denmark, is higher in other countries in the first week, months of losing a job. So I think actually that money should be higher than it is now and taper off over time. Most countries do that. We don't, and we should do it. There's talk about doing it. But of the people who are unemployed, most of them are just between jobs. Mm. It's only a smaller fraction who have been unemployed for 3 years or more. Most of those people are just between jobs and getting helped out before they get a new job.
And again, just from my Morgan McKinley hat on, just be very clear, for all of the talk in the last 12 months, the demand for talent is absolutely enormous. And there are organisations struggling to find the people to do the jobs. And again, I know we're not going to discuss it today because it's my first time in 12 months and they haven't discussed immigration. Mm. For Ireland to even fulfil, Dan, as I understand it, even the most minimum level of economic growth, we will require tens of thousands of workers to come to this country with skills to fulfil those roles. So that's the first thing that, as a country, so first of all, every opportunity I can say it, immigration to Ireland, it's permanent, it's positive, and it's something that we will not be able to function without. So again, unless there's going to be a strategic plan with regard to immigration in a proper sense, we'll continue to have this problem ongoing. And it affects issues of housing. You know, I don't know if I saw it today, they're spending 299,000 on 11 bedrooms for, I think it was in the Department of Defence or the Army, because they're putting people up. So it's all interconnected. But dear God, it's not beyond the wit of the departments to come together and work these things out. But bottom line is, Ireland is at full employment. The economy is booming. Now, by the way, we've also to acknowledge, look at the world we're in now. The American election is going to have, I believe, potentially a really material impact on Ireland, and depending on the outcome. Look what's happening across Europe, because again, so many European countries are struggling. Germany just seems to, Olaf Scholz seems to just failed to grasp any issue, and they really are struggling. So we can take nothing for granted, and we can't squander it.
Okay, my wife's South American. I spend most of my adult life as an economic migrant in other countries. I'm a sort of one of those globalist pro-migration people. Doesn't make me a morally better person than people who want society to be full of people more like them. We haven't had a discussion. John is absolutely right. Overall, if you look at it from an economic perspective, migration has been very positive. But many people feel uncomfortable about the scale of change. Mm. And particularly over the past 30 months, we have seen a massive increase in immigration, and many people are uncomfortable about that. They're not all racists. And we need to have a balanced conversation about how much migration. You're absolutely for economically, but we live in a society as well as an economy, as people say. And if people feel uncomfortable about the rate of change, do you give all the tech companies every work permit they want? Everybody who comes in as a working for the tech companies is paying tax, adding to the economy, but they also need houses, they need services. We just need to have a debate about migration without accusing anybody who is any way saying there's too much as being a racist. I'm of a particular view, but I am not a morally better person than somebody who says we should have less immigration.
On that note, we're going to pick up with a couple of the lighter stories in the papers after this quick break. First, we're going to check on the weather, because it's gone a bit off of wintry, hasn't it? A bit manky, dare I say, is the technical word. Joining me now is Cathal Nolan, founder of Ireland's Weather Channel. Cathal, you do not come bearing good news, unfortunately.
I generally don't when I'm brought on these particular and certainly not so on this occasion. We have quite a number of weather warnings in place right across the country at the moment, especially so for the southern half of the country, and especially so, it must be said, for coastal areas of the south and southeast. Here we have status orange weather warnings in place for some very heavy falls of rain, and with that, the likelihood of localised flooding, and accompanying that, also some quite strong winds as well.
Yeah, so we've got in Cork and Waterford, you've got an orange from now, basically, from 8 o'clock this morning, and the rest of the southeast affected. Where has a yellow rain and wind warning?
The main areas, I suppose, as we said, are across coastal areas of the south and the southeast. Now, between these two areas in particular, we expect to see inwards of 50 to 60 millimetres rainfall falling quite widely across this area. Now, there is an area in particular in West Waterford, in and around about the Dungarvan area, over the Cumbria Mountains. Here, some of the high-resolution weather models are indicating that we could see anywhere between 100 to 130 millimetres of rain. That's between about 4 and 5 inches of rain, which would be over a month total worth of rainfall within the space of about 12 to 18 hours. So really quite exceptional quantities are expected in this area. And with that, there is a likelihood of flooding also. So if you are in that particular area, please do stay up to date with the weather warnings, as it could be quite significant as we get towards higher tide later on this evening at 5 p.m.
Yeah, sunny southeast not living up to its name, unfortunately. Is the summer officially gone? Are we any hope of an Indian summer coming in the last few weeks, or should I just give up and get all the jumpers out now?
I think we got our Indian summer potentially out of the way. Was it last week before last? Where we had much warmer conditions, temperatures into the low 20s in many parts of the country, and good sunshine. Of course, many of us who attended the ploughing will certainly have commented on the fabulous weather that was encountered this year as opposed to last year. In terms of the return, let's say, of an Indian summer-like conditions, it's really looking unlikely at the moment when we look at the longer-range weather models. While we will see an improvement into the start of next week, for many of us, high pressure does come in and settle things down a little bit. It doesn't look like lasting particularly long. We will see a return to more unsettled conditions after that. So unfortunately, I think we can safely say that summer 2024, which, to be quite honest, never really got going in many ways, is likely and certainly has passed.
Cathal Nolan, thanks for drawing a line under summer 2024 for us there. That's nice and cheerful for me as always. What's that old joke? Yeah, Ireland's summer was great. It was a brilliant week. Something like that. We are going to return to our paper panel now. John Cunningham, Sinead Moriarty and Dan O'Brien are with me. And Sinead, one of the stories that kind of caught my eye a little bit actually in the paper is about cinema, and that actually this is being dubbed as somewhat of a bumper year, because it's been a weird few years for the arts in the COVID. Probably very good for book sales, but not so good for cinema and other things.
No, and actually they were saying that, you know, the bumps on seats isn't back to pre-COVID yet. But I think just to comment on one of the best movies I've seen, and it also happens to be Irish, which is equally brilliant, is Kneecap. I would encourage anybody to go and see it. It is a wild ride. It's absolutely brilliant. But interestingly, I was working with a New Zealand writer this week. He's Maori, and he went to see it, and he said he was incredibly moved by the parallels between, you know, Irish people trying to save their language, because Kneecap is about Irish rappers, and the parallels between what the Maoris have had to do to try and save their language. And he just said he was incredibly moved by it, and he thinks it's a very universal film, and I think it's going to be absolutely massive, and I think it's going to get a lot of awards.
Have any of the rest of you been to the cinema this year? I have to admit I haven't.
We had a COVID baby, so I haven't been to the cinema since before COVID. So I'm speaking out of this conversation.
You're fully out.
We'd be cinema goers. And again, I always think that it's always great on a Sunday evening before the week go back to work. It's like a nice end to the evening. But I can get access to the Stella Cinema in Rathmines, which I think recently won the best cinema in the world or in Europe, whatever else. So between the Swan Centre and Stella. But what I'm loving is now that they're bringing back old movies. So I went to see Whatever Happened to Baby Jane,
awesome.
The Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. And I mean, on a Saturday afternoon, to go in and sit down and have a beer and a packet of popcorn, it's fantastic. But I think it's funny, people have forgotten forgotten how to go to the cinema and how enjoyable it is. But it looks like it is re-emerging, and I think it's a really important part of our cultural life. And I think, again, back to that arts point, you know, that again, one, what's happening in Irish cinema and Irish acting and Irish arts is really still quite extraordinary. And I think for all of the giving out, Catherine Martin needs to be given a very clear shout out to what she's done as Minister for the Arts and supporting it directly. And again, just to encourage people today, I'm on the board of IMA. There's three exhibitions in IMA at the moment. There's Hilary Herron, the Take a Breath, and a wonderful exhibition by Melanie Bonaggio. And remember, it's free access. It's in the Royal Hospital Kilmainham. And because of that strategic funding, there's some really, really powerful things to do that are for free.
And the Dublin Theatre Festival is on, and there are plenty of shows to see. Go online and book.
Very good. On that note, we shall leave it. My thank you to my panel, Sinead Moriarty, writer and author, who herself has two books on the go at the minute, Fixing Mom and Dad and Good Sisters. John Cunningham, Chair of the SERP Institute, Relationship Director at Morgan McKinley and Chairman, Country Director at the License Group, and Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.